The Sounds True Podcast Network.
Sometimes, well, some bad thing that could happen in one's life, you think, well, that's my excuse. You know, if that happens, then of course I could have a drink or I could do drugs. Like, wouldn't you want to take the edge off? But I realized early on that there were no conditions that I could put on my recovery.
In this episode of Insights at the Edge, my guest is Stephen Washington. Stephen helps people in recovery stay grounded and focused through mindfulness and movement. He was a professional Broadway dancer and is now an acclaimed Qigong and Pilates teacher. He's the author of the book, Recovering You, Soul Care and Mindful Movement for Overcoming Addiction. And he's the creator of the Stephen Washington Experience, the SWE Studio. It's an affordable online community that offers movement, meditation, and more. Friends, stay with us. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you so much, Tammy. It's lovely to meet you and to be here with you.
We're getting to know each other for the first time, and I imagine many of our listeners are getting to know you for the first time as well. So if you would, can you trace us back? It's now been, if I understand correctly, 23 years ago that you officially entered recovery, or from one perspective, you could say you admitted to yourself that you quote-unquote hit bottom. I'd love to know about that and a little bit about what this recovery journey has been like for you.
Gosh, 23 years ago, when I first decided or understood and admitted that I had a problem with drugs and alcohol, and that my life had become unmanageable, feels like a lifetime ago, and it also feels like yesterday. Especially when I was just saying before this conversation began, I was saying that I saw some friends here in the Palm Springs area that I actually got sober with, and that we're all still sober. And it just brings back so many memories. But if I can encapsulate what it was like for me, it was fun. And then it was fun with problems. And then it was just problems. Ultimately, that was my journey with substances. I felt very uncomfortable in my body. I felt like I'm a very sensitive person, still am, and this dense plane was just too much for me. And I sought escape through things outside of myself, like drugs and alcohol and food, etc. And for a long time it worked, until it didn't work anymore. And luckily I had people around me, a few people, one in particular who was in recovery. His name is Craig. And he wore recovery beautifully. He just seemed happy, joyous, and free. And I was just wounded just enough that I was willing to think about making a change and a shift, and to let go of what I had considered to be my best friends for so long, alcohol and drugs, and try something new. And I'm so glad that I did, because it's changed my life forever. And we'll get into this later in terms of life is a complicated experience that we all have. And there are ups and there are downs. And what I've committed myself to is, no matter what is happening in my life, my recovery is non-negotiable. Because without my recovery, nothing else that's really beautiful is possible. So, you know, that's my, how I kind of got here, like what got me into the world of recovery. And while I've been in recovery, so many things have happened and so many beautiful opportunities have come my way that have led me to this moment of talking to you. Led me to writing my book, led me to the work that I do helping other people in recovery or anyone who is seeking any kind of change or transformation. It's been an experience of following my intuition in terms of where I need to go. I felt like once I left my dance career on Broadway, I started to teach Pilates in New York City, and I had a strong desire to help my clients in deeper ways. And my first thought was to become a Chinese medicine doctor. And so I began that journey of studying Chinese medicine, and I moved from New York to California to do so. Worked really hard to get into a program. Took me a couple of years to get into one, only to find out once I was there that it wasn't the right place for me. Which, to some people, that wouldn't seem like a big deal. But for me, I come from a mindset of like, once you start something, you got to finish it. There's no such thing as changing your mind. Really powerful lesson to learn that you can always change your mind, no matter what. And so while in Chinese medicine school, a semester in, I realized that my path was massage therapy. So I moved into massage therapy, but I later discovered that one of the reasons why I ended up in Chinese medicine school was to become introduced to Qigong. That's why I first experienced Qigong. And the universe created a situation for me that was incredibly stressful. Like that period of my life, I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to stay sober because the amount of stress that I was under going back to grad school was huge. But there was something about the medicine of Qigong that helped me zoom out and get the bigger picture of the experience and what it was here to teach me and how it was going to help me grow and how I would be able to take this and help other people with that medicine.
I want to go deeper, especially into the insights that have impacted your life from Qigong. But before we do, I just want to pull one little thread of something you said. My recovery is not negotiable. It's non-negotiable. What does that mean? Does that mean that engaging in any consumption of drugs and alcohol is not negotiable? Or what do you mean by that statement? My recovery is not negotiable.
The best way that I can describe it is sometimes we can place conditions on our commitment to something. When I first got sober, I often heard about big things happening in people's lives, like losing a loved one, losing a child, battling some sort of health crisis or what have you, and people not being sure that whether they could stay sober through that. And sometimes, well, some bad thing that could happen in one's life, you think, well, that's my excuse. You know, if that happens, then of course I could have a drink, or I could do drugs. I could, you know, like, wouldn't you want to take the edge off? But I realized early on that there were no conditions that I could put on my recovery. Like when my stepmother died and I was grieving, and when my father died and I was grieving, having a drink over it wasn't going to make it any better. I would still have the grief, and then I'd have active addiction to deal with all over again. And so there've been lots of things in my life that have happened that have been challenging, or, you know, even not so challenging. We can be challenged by beautiful things happening, because anything, whether it's a good thing or what we call quote unquote bad, can be stressful, and we can respond to stress in various ways. And for me, I used to respond to stress by using. So many things have happened, and I could have used alcohol or drugs again, but I've chosen not to because I know what I'll get when I'll do that. It's very clear. My history, my story lays it out very clearly what happens when I pick up a drink or a drug or anything else that I have used addictively. So that's basically what I mean. There's no negotiating in terms of that. I don't drink, I don't use, no matter what.
In your book, Recovering You, you talk about the importance of having a trigger plan. And I want to hear more about that. And it sounds like you believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that it's important to have a trigger plan for small things and big things.
Yeah, it's important to think, well, first of all, I think when it comes to recovery, everyone should know that we have triggers. There are things that are going to trigger you, people, places, and things. And to think that you will rise above that and not be impacted by things outside of yourself that will make you feel uncomfortable and make you desire to regulate. Because I think at the heart of all this, it's a desire to regulate one's nervous system, right? It's just important to think it through. Don't wait until you're in the crisis. Give some thought to the things that habitually trigger you, whether it's a person in your life. Like I think about when I first got sober, there were people that I used to use with. And I had to figure out a way to take care of myself around those people. And that sometimes meant limiting the time I spent with those people or lovingly letting them go. When I had an event where alcohol was going to be served, and I used to, like I said, I used to dance professionally, I was on Broadway, there was always a party. There's always an opening night party, closing night party, going away party, whatever. I had to come up with a plan of action of how I would handle those situations. And sometimes it was, I would call someone before I'd walk in the door to the party just to say, hey, I'm walking into this party. I'm feeling a little nervous. I just want to let you know. And maybe make a plan to call them afterwards. Just say, hey, I'm leaving the party. I made it okay. I didn't drink. And just knowing that person is just a phone call away was really helpful to me. There was streets that I couldn't walk on when I was in recovery, early recovery, because I used to go to bars. And whenever I'd walk down those streets, I'd be flooded with memories and it would make me feel uncomfortable. Even with music, there's some music I had to stop listening to initially because it triggered me. So just being conscious of those things and figuring out how you're going to navigate it, because it is going to happen and you don't want it to catch you completely off guard and pull the rug out from underneath you. You want to be able to say, oh, okay, I'm feeling triggered. Okay, take a deep breath. Okay, what's the next right action for me to take? Let me call so-and-so. Let me not walk down that street. Let me go take another route. So that's my strategy when it comes to the triggers, especially for someone who's early in their recovery.
Now, you mentioned this big event in your life, thinking you were going to be a Chinese medical doctor, and instead not pursuing that, but having discovered the practice of Qigong, and that you're not the kind of person who quits anything, but you had to quit that program. What did you learn about how to get through that? And I guess I would say sober or clean and sober. What words would you use?
I would say sober, but also understanding the spiritual through line that was happening in the experience. Whenever I think about that time of my life and the big lesson, the big takeaway from that is asking for help. To ask for help, which for me does not come easy. I grew up in an environment where you don't tell anyone your business. You keep it all to yourself. You pull yourself up by your bootstraps and get on with it. And so for me to admit that I had changed my mind about becoming a Chinese medicine doctor after I moved to California from New York, I told everyone that this is what I was going to do. I was so certain. I just felt a lot of shame. And for me, part of my story is when I went to undergrad, when I was a young dancer in New York, I went to NYU. And I didn't graduate from NYU. I did about 3 years and then I left that program. And so going into Chinese medicine school and coming to a similar crossroads, I felt like a failure. And then I realized, no, I'm not a failure. And it's not that I can't do this work. It's that I'm making another choice and I have the power and the right to make a different choice. And we make choices based on the information that we have. But nonetheless, it taught me how to ask for help. I had to ask people how to help me study because I did not know how to study and work at that level in Chinese medicine school. And I got so much help that I actually became a very good student there. I had to go to meetings and share with people that I thought about drinking and that the stress was just too much for me and that I was sitting in my car before going into class and crying in my car. It taught me to let people in. And I thought I'd learned that lesson long before when I got sober, when I admitted to someone that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. I thought I could check that off my list. But what I understand, especially from that experience, is that there are so many different layers and levels to the lessons that we learn. I know that we often talk about peeling back the layers of an onion. Every lesson is like an onion and you keep peeling back the layers and there's more and there's more. You always are progressing and gaining knowledge and competency, but there's always more. So that's my greatest lesson that I learned.
What would you say to someone who doesn't find asking for help easy, doesn't come naturally to them? They don't want to do it. What would you say?
Yeah. Well, and this kind of goes back to in my book, there's a chapter on social support and how important social support is. And one of my friends that I interviewed for the book talked about how when she first got sober, she had to get into the habit of connecting with people when the shit hadn't hit the fan. You want to practice that when the stakes are small for little things so that when the big things happen, you're already well practiced at asking for help, having a social support network, starting small. And for some people, the inability to ask for help is sometimes, I think, related to anxiety, social anxiety sometimes, just not knowing how to connect with people, not wanting to feel inadequate. And I think what prepares you to be able to ask for help is just what you do and just nurturing the relationships you have in your life and the time that you spend with people and the way that you connect with people. And you don't need a million people in your life. You just have a handful of people that make you feel like yourself, that you see yourself, that you feel loved and supported, not for what you can give them or for becoming what you think they want you to be, you just being who you are. I think that's those are the building blocks to being in a point where you could ask someone for help. And when you're willing to help others, I think when you're willing to help others, that puts you more in a position of when the tables turn, because eventually they will turn. People need people. We're more able to do that because we're already in that flow of help, that flow of helping and support.
You mentioned, Stephen, that shame came up for you when here you told all these people, I'm going to do this thing and you're not going to do this thing. And it resonated with not graduating from college. I didn't graduate from college either. But in your book, Recovering, that's an aside, in your book, Recovering You, you say that shame is the linchpin of addiction. And I wanted to understand more how you see that.
I think shame for me is underneath so much of what allowed my addictive tendencies to flourish. And it's not even, you know, shame is this sense that we are not good, that there's something inherently wrong with us. And what I've discovered in my own story in writing that book was there's a lot of shame that I inherited as well. Shame that didn't even belong to me, but I took it on. Oh, yeah. Unbeknownst to me. And then later on in life, I had to just sort of dissect things and unpack it all. But when you don't feel that you are worthy enough to take up the space that you take up in the world, then what incentive is there to take care of yourself and value yourself if you don't feel as though you are worthy, that you are less than? And so for me, that underlying, that through line of shame fed my addiction. It made it easy for me to pick up that drink or to smoke that joint and to just check out and not have to deal with the underlying shame that I didn't really even know existed for me. It took some time for me to understand that that's what was at play. Going back to this being the linchpin of addiction, that shame and fear, I think are through lines, threads in that tapestry. And once you start pulling at the thread, you start to see what's really there. And if you just keep pulling, you're able to unravel what's there and what's been built up and start to heal. Because you can't fix something. You can't change something that you won't admit or acknowledge is there.
All right. So let's talk to that person who says, look, I can certainly identify shame. I know it. I've seen it. I know how it's operating in my life. What's been hard is to actually know how to heal it in a lasting way. And I know you've been teaching on healing shame and having it transform into self-compassion. And I think that's a topic that a lot of us would like to hear more on.
Hmm. For the person who is struggling with shame, I think the first step is to acknowledge that that's what's happening for you and understand when it's being triggered. And I think what's been healing for me when it comes to shame has been to not keep it a secret. To share it with someone that you trust. And that could be a therapist. For me, it was a therapist. For me, it was also a recovery sponsor, a mentor. It could be a spiritual figure in your life, someone that you trust and know that they have your well-being. They prioritize your well-being. What can happen sometimes is people share their shame with people who have not earned the right to hear that shame and can't hold space for you. So being discerning about who you choose to share this tender part of yourself with. So that's been a really important part of healing and what I teach people and share with people. But I also teach people how to connect to their body, because we hold shame in our body. We hold emotions in the body. And if we take time to practice breath work, practice becoming aware of the sensations in our body through meditation, doing practices like Qigong, where we move the physical energy, the emotional energy through the body, and it allows us to pay attention. So much of what we're talking about operates underneath our, you know, our awareness and our level of consciousness. And it's not until we stop, slow down, get still enough, are we able to see what's there and begin to unpack it in a very loving and nurturing and compassionate way. So I always encourage people to move their body, to connect to nature in some way, to check in. We're all moving at a million miles per hour. So many things are pulling at us, and it's easy to become distracted and pulled away from the deeper parts of ourselves. So as far as shame is concerned, I would say getting quiet, getting still, moving the body, finding someone to share your shame with, having conversations about it, allowing others to help you, allow them to hold space for you.
And a follow-up question, Stephen, because when you first started talking about shame, you said, and it's not necessarily all even yours, or that's what I heard you say, like from this lifetime, or I want to see if you could make clear what you were pointing to there in your own experience.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. So when I was growing up, my father remarried and married my stepmother, Diane, who I loved dearly. And I remember being a 10-year-old kid, and at that time, I think Happy Days was on television, and the Fonz wore his white t-shirts with the sleeves rolled up or what have you. So I took a white t-shirt and I cut the sleeves off.
Yeah.
And because I thought that was cool.
Yeah.
And she was furious with me. And it wasn't like we were poor and didn't have money and how dare I cut up a shirt, you know, cost so much. Wasn't that? She said, "You look like one of those homosexuals." I was 10 years old. I didn't even know what that meant, but I knew whatever it was not good. And so all these years later, I can talk about it because it's something that I latched onto and took on. Like there was a deep sense of fear in her mind around people who were gay. And so much so that I have another family member who was gay, and they never came out to her his entire life. Meanwhile, I'm 18 and I come out. but that's what I mean in terms of shame that's adopted and you taken on. And I held that for a long time, and I'm sure that fed into my feelings of low self-worth and feelings of being less than, or feelings of being bad or dirty because I liked other boys. So that's the shame that I'm referring to in terms of taking on someone else's shame. I have no idea what happened to her in her life that led her to have that belief. And it's not uncommon, but it's amazing how that it's contagious. Shame is contagious.
Yeah, that's a great example. Really makes it real. Thank you. Talked about also what we carry in our bodies. What I thought about is how many of us have body shame of some kind. And here you are, you're working with people with Qigong movements and Pilates, but you're dancing with people and you're shirtless on YouTube, I have to say. And you're clearly making a statement, I think, in that of, you know, we can love and accept and move our bodies and be in a joyful place. And so I'd love to hear your insights on working with people to heal body shame specifically. Mm.
I love this question because from the moment I started doing this work of teaching people, particularly Qigong, I started to teach it in environments for people who are, you know, who consider themselves to be highly sensitive and intuitive. And what I discovered was that a lot of them were very disconnected from their bodies. They had spent so much time focusing on their minds and their connection to spirit, but were not connected to their bodies for various reasons. I'm sure for some people it's because of trauma. I'm sure some people endured sexual abuse or physical abuse. Many reasons why one would want to kind of leave their body. And so getting them in these live events or even online, getting them to feel comfortable enough to move their body and observe the sensations in their body and not be also self-conscious was quite a process. And one of the things that I started to do was try to meet people wherever they were at. If they weren't able to do the movement as I am demonstrating the movement, I would invite them to envision, imagine themselves moving their body in that way? Like, what would it be like if you imagine that you were moving your body in the way that I'm moving my body? And if that's not available to you, just like connecting to your breath, putting your hands on your belly and just taking some deep breaths and just feeling your body breathe. To slowly start to kind of reintroduce the person to their body again and change perhaps the narrative that they have around their body. At the heart of what I teach is self-care. And one of the goals that I have in teaching self-care is to help people truly embrace the fact that they deserve to take good care of themselves. Like, they deserve care. And that the best person to care for them is themselves. And that's something that's available to them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so really meeting people wherever they're at and letting them know that they don't have to do it perfectly. There's a sense that many of us have that if we can't do something perfectly, then why even bother? It's amazing how much pressure we put on ourselves. We try something new for the very first time, never done it before ever, but we expect that when we do it, we're going to do it perfectly. No one can correct them or anything like that. So I want to remind them that the goal is not to do it perfectly. The goal is just to have an experience and just to notice what comes up in the experience and just be open to it. Just be open.
What about the kind of body shame that's like, I'm too fat in this part of my body, or I'm too short, or I don't know, whatever it might be for someone?
Oh, gosh. I think that's a really good question. That's a really good question. And I like to remind people that change is possible. Like, if you desire to change something about yourself, that it's possible to do. It is possible to do if you choose to do it. But that has to be your own choice. If someone feels self-conscious about their weight, they can change that about themselves if they choose to, but they don't have to. That's a tough one, Tammy. That's a tough one for me to.
Well, I still feel inspired by your answer about connecting with our bodies, and if it's something we can change, knowing we can.
I think, yeah, you know, and having you say that just reminds me about something. You know, one of the greatest gifts that I've gotten in recovery is acceptance. Learning to accept the things I cannot change. And there's some things about myself that no matter how hard I'll try, I may not be able to change it. For instance, I'm a nail biter. I've been biting my nails ever since I was a kid. And I've had a lot of shame about that in my life. But I had this thought several years ago of, Stephen, what if you never stop biting your nails? Can you live with that? Are you going to wait to be happy, waiting for that day that you suddenly don't have this habit anymore to like be happy or love yourself as much as you possibly can? Or are you going to do it now? And what I came to realize is like, I'm going to do that now. So I might bite my nails until I'm 99 years old, and that's okay. And I say to the person who has something about themselves that they don't particularly love, I just invite them to be more compassionate to themselves and to not put off their sense of wholeness waiting on something to change. Like, can we change our thoughts and our feelings about the thing? Not necessarily changing the thing, but can we change our relationship to the thing? I like to guide people to a place of being able to change their relationship with the thing, change their perceptions, their perspective, there's so much potential there for that.
Stephen, I'm also a nail biter, so I'm just going to take a moment here. This isn't a particularly, now I look like some kind of strange clawed figure, like a sloth or something. This is a particularly short moment in my nails. It's been a it's been a challenging week. Sometimes they're longer. Okay, I've demonstrated. Here we are, you and I together.
You
brother.
Know? Yeah.
Here
you
we
know?
Are.
Yeah, yeah. I hope that my analogy was able to illustrate the point.
It landed for me. I usually keep my hands, you know, way below the camera. I've never done that before. This is a moment. You know, it's a moment.
Thank you for, I'm glad you felt comfortable enough to do that.
Well, I think that part of it too was when you were talking about anything that we're ashamed about and the power of sharing it and talking about it. I was thinking about the proven healing power of confession of any kind. And just when you air it out, it shifts. Now, I want to pick up on one other thread because a couple of times you've mentioned the connection between sensitivity, at least for you, and addiction. And in Recovering You, you talk about a kind of working idea you have that a lot of times when people are addicted, they're also sensitive people, that's a component of their addiction. And I wanted to hear more about that.
That came to my attention in all my years of going to recovery meetings and just listening to people's stories and meeting people, and also just looking at my own experience and who I am. I'm a very sensitive person. And I just was able to identify that one of the reasons why I use substances was to feel okay in my body and to feel okay in the world. It helped me be more social and be more connected to people. And so I was able to identify that sensitivity is a common thread with a lot of us. So how do we take that sensitivity and nurture it in another way? And I think practices like Qigong, practices like breathwork and meditation help us to check in and tune into that in our inner world, our inner life, and to discover things about ourselves that we might not have known about, and to embrace that and to nurture it instead of trying to mask it or sweep it under the rug or pretend that it's not there. It's kind of like, I think of sensitivity, much like I think Anita Morjani's book about sensitive is the new strong or something like that, that our sensitivity is like a superpower. And it's all about how we work with it and what our beliefs are around it and how do we nurture it. For me, it's definitely an asset. And I think my work helps to empower people to find healthy ways to connect with their sensitivity, regulate their nervous system, because oftentimes when we're sensitive and we feel triggered, it triggers our nervous system and we're just trying to figure out ways to go from fight or flight back to a more restful, relaxed state. But there's definitely that connection for me and for many with sensitivity and addiction and just a way to feel okay in the world.
What are your beliefs now about your sensitivity?
Oh, my sensitivity? I believe that it's what helps me connect with people. It helps me to connect with people to remind myself that I'm not alone. And to remind them that they aren't alone as well, and that their sensitivity is there is a tremendous asset, and that it allows them to connect to the deeper parts of themselves, to really understand themselves. I really believe, especially in this season of my life, that I'm like the best version of myself, in part because I am so in tune with my sensitivity. And that includes my intuition. And listening to that still small voice inside of me. And so I always encourage people to do the same to the best of their abilities. And I think the more I can do that for myself and to illustrate that, it gives people permission to do their version of that as well.
All right, Stephen, here's something I really want to talk to you about. As I was reading Recovering You, one of the things I learned that you wrote about you, is that trusting a power higher than yourself didn't at first come naturally to you.
Yeah.
But yet it's something that has now emerged in you as a kind of bedrock of your life. And that's what I want to hear. What was your journey to trust a power higher than you?
Well, it's important to note that I grew up Southern Baptist. And so it was a lot of fire, a lot of brimstone. And I always felt like I didn't have a place in that environment because I knew I was different. And so I always felt a certain sense of shame about what I knew about myself intuitively. And I always felt like church was not a safe place for me. And I didn't believe that. I believe that God knew about me, but didn't necessarily care. And one of the things that my recovery has taught me is that my higher power can be whatever it is that I want it to be. Like, I get to define what my higher power is. And my higher power is a loving, caring, funny, sensitive, strong, smart energy that wants only good things for me, wants me to grow and be the best version of myself. So it was a long journey to understand that and give myself the freedom to define that for myself. And in part, I learned how to do that because I watched other people do it. I watched a wide variety of different people share their concept of a higher power, their connection to whatever it is that they would choose to call God. And so that was incredibly freeing. And it's something that has unfolded for me, much like I was saying earlier, that peeling back of the layer of the onion. I feel as though my connection to my higher power just grows in a very beautiful, organic way. And I just discover more and more and more, and the relationship gets more and more comfortable and casual. Like, I love when I have moments when I drop in the prayer and I'm talking to my higher power like I'm talking to you. Like, for years I would say rote prayers like the Serenity Prayer, which I still use every now and again, or the Our Father or something like that. But it's just, I'm just saying words. But when I talk to my higher power, just like I'm talking to you right now, it's different. It feels more real. It feels more connective. It feels more regulating. It feels more aligned. And so that's just one example of how it's evolved for me over time. And it's something that's really exciting to me because I keep learning so many subtle things each and every day through this work. I became a certified meditation teacher about a year and a half ago, and I absolutely adored that journey because it allowed me to really dive into that inner world, that inner space, to really just listen. And that's a space that I used to be uncomfortable with, you know, being still enough to listen, was just something that was hard. Like, in recovery, they talk about prayer and meditation being an important part of recovery. And I was like, I got the prayer thing down, but the meditation? Oh, until I heard somebody say that meditation could be as simple as you sitting down, being quiet, looking out the window while you're waiting for the water to boil. Like, that's a, like, start where you are. And so I've really enjoyed this process of going deeper and listening and connecting to my higher power.
Now, you described, Stephen, your higher power all these positive words, energy that wants what's good for you. And I wonder, when something that doesn't seem good, untoward, unwanted, you know, when the you know what hits the fan, how do you work with that in such a way? Oh, the universe, this energy wants what's good for me. This sure doesn't look very good. This looks like fucking hell.
Wow. That's a really good question. And truthfully?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Always truthfully. I have yet to... I have yet to yell out at my higher power when something difficult happens. For instance, a few years ago, I went through a divorce, and that was one of the most difficult things I've ever had to experience. I come from a family of divorce, and that's the last thing I wanted for myself. But when I moved through that process, I don't recall ever once saying, you know, why me? Why is this happening? How is this going to benefit or work in my favor or be in service to my growth and development? I never questioned that. And I very quickly got into the headspace of like, okay, this is happening for me. I might not have all the details of how and why this is happening for me, but I'm going to actively search this experience for that, because I knew it was going to be ripe with that. And I one thing that I have never really thought of when it comes to my God was I've never really thought that, oh, it's my God's job to make everything comfortable for me. It's what my higher power does for me is it gives me the tools that I need to navigate the tough stuff. Doesn't mean I'm not going to experience the tough stuff, but I have the tools in which to navigate it, and the support and everything that's going to help me take what's come my way and utilize it to become an even better version of myself. And what I've started to do with it all and with everything I've done, like even from just from the very beginning of this conversation, just we started talking about recovery. Early on, I saw how my recovery and my journey with recovery could help somebody else. And so that's why from the very beginning, when I began having a presence online, it was around my recovery and things, my family issues, because I know there are lots of people out there who are going through something similar, and they might feel alone. They might feel like no one understands what they're going through. And I want them to know that, hey, you're not alone. And I've gone through that too. I'm going through it now. And this is what's helping me. And maybe it'll help you.
What about that person who's does have this notion that their life is supposed to be somehow their faith is supposed to deliver them a path that doesn't have terribly hard challenges? That seems like something that maybe needs to get examined in some way, because I mean, yeah. all of us get wacky curveballs.
We do. And I think it comes back to acceptance. Like the greatest gift I've gotten in recovery is just this ability to accept the things that I can't change. It doesn't mean I got to like it. Like, I didn't like getting a divorce. You know, it was quite the opposite. But I understood that this is what it was, and that there could be something really positive that comes out of it. And, you know, I think for the person who's struggling with that, everyone has to go through their own experience of kind of butting their heads against the wall, trying to create something that's not really in alignment with where the energies in their life are leading and going. And everyone's journey to acceptance is different. So that person is like, just, you know, hang in there, try to take care of yourself as you move through this, be gentle with yourself as you move through this. But sometimes people have to fall a bit more before they can get up, or before they have that awakening that this thing that has been very deeply uncomfortable for them is actually something that's going to bear fruit for them, and only a way that they're going to be able to identify how that is so.
Beautiful. In Recovering You, you introduce lots of different practices. Each chapter has guidelines for self-inquiry, along with a type of Qigong-inspired movement breath practice. And you introduce the notion of doing breath prayers. And I wonder if you could share a bit about that, and if we might be able to even, you ready for this, do it together.
Yeah, I love that. So when I was writing the book, I just did some research around this idea of using breath and coordinating it with a prayer and making it as simple as possible. Whereas with each breath that you take into your body, you imagine something that you want to cultivate in your life, something that you want more of, whether that's peace or love or balance or health. And then when the exhale, releasing whatever it is that might be standing in the way of you achieving this. And so, like for you, Tammy, think about what one thing is that you want to cultivate into your life. If you can think about it in one word. And then think about that one word that describes what might be standing in the way. And then from there, just sitting where you are, just take the hands and lift them up and allow the palms to face your body, face your heart. And take a deep breath in through your nose. And as you do so, bring the hands towards the heart, drawing in more of what you want to cultivate. And then allow the palms to face away from you. And as you exhale, release whatever it is that might be standing in the way. Palms face you. Inhale, drawing in the energy you want to cultivate. Exhale, releasing anything that is standing in the way. Inhale. Exhale. Let's do this three more times. One last time. And float your arms down, hands rest on your lap. And now we're back.
Terrific, simple practice, Stephen. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. Here, as we end, I promised that I wanted to talk a little bit more about Qigong. And the reason I bring that up is I've done some practice with a couple of different Qigong teachers, and I really did take to it like a duck to water. I just loved it so much. And, you know, if I were to try to say, why did I love it so much? I don't know. It was easy. So I loved that. Energy flowed. I felt grounded. I could feel a sort of energetic alignment in front of the spine. My hands lit up with energy. I mean, these are some of the things I love about it. But what I'm curious, as we conclude our conversation, is if I were to say, Stephen, tell me, what are the core Qigong insights that now pervade your life as someone in recovery? what would you say from Qigong, that practice specifically?
Key insights. First thing that comes to mind is there's always more than meets the eye. So Qigong, like I said from the very beginning, my first experience with it allowed me to zoom out and see the big picture. So when we're moving through life, it's so easy to just have tunnel vision. So Qigong is such an expansive practice that we get to zoom out and just appreciate all the different facets of our experience. And that impacts the way that we move and what our next step will be. So that's a key insight, and that I can impact the way that I feel by how I breathe. And my breathing impacts how I feel. And whether that's doing a simple breathwork practice or doing mindful breathing as I'm moving the body, I can change my state of being. And when I was in active addiction, that's all I was really trying to do, is trying to change my state of being. But now I can change my state of being in a more holistic way. So that's a key insight that I have from my Qigong practice. And just this reminder that everything is energy. Everything is energy. And it's all the same energy, but different manifestations of it, like ice turning to water, water turning to mist. It's all H2O, which is different forms of it. So I tend to look at the world with that in mind, that everything is energy and that our energies interact, and how sometimes they interact in a way like this, and sometimes they interact in a way like this, and sometimes they interact in a way like that. So just to be sensitive to it all.
I've been talking with Stephen Washington. He's the author of the book Recovering You, Soul Care and Mindful Movement for Overcoming Addiction. And he's created the SWE Studio, which is an online community that offers movement, meditation, and more. Stephen, what a warm presence, warm and loving, accepting, truth-telling presence you have. I've really enjoyed our time here. Thank you so much. Thanks for being you, making your recovery non-negotiable. Thank you.
Thank you. So great to have this time with you. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, friends. Thanks for being with us. And if you'd like to watch Insights at the Edge on video and participate in the after-show Q&A session with our guests, come join us on Sounds True One, a new membership community featuring award-winning original shows, live classes, community learning, guided meditations, and more with the leading wisdom teachers of our time. Use promo code PODCAST to get your first month free. You can learn more at join.soundstrue.com. Sounds True, waking up the world. The Sounds True Podcast Network.